And Dean thinks it's the wrath of the God of Abraham. Yeah, that's definitely the guy we want leading the nation in perilous times. Dean's epiphanic religious awakening occurred over a bike path, and that's his version of what happened. He was baptized Catholic and raised an Episcopalian, but left the Episcopal Church in a huff when he finally found his true religion, environmentally friendly exercise. The Episcopalians don't demand much in the way of actual religious belief. They have girl priests, gay bishops, gay marriages. It's much like the New York Times editorial board. They acknowledge the Ten Commandments, or Moses' talking points, but hasten to add that they're not exactly carved in stone. After Bush said that the most important philosopher to him was Jesus Christ, the Episcopal bishop in Des Moines, Iowa, C. Christopher Epting, said the answer was a turnoff. So there isn't a lot of hair shirt wearing and sacrifice for the Episcopalians. But the bike path incident was too much for Dean. A key tenet of the druidical religion of liberals is non-fossil fuel travel. So Dean left the Church of the Proper Fork because the Episcopal Church in Montpelier hesitated before ceding some of its land for a bike path. On CNN, Judy Woodruff asked Dean in amazement, "Was it just over a bike path that you left the Episcopal Church?" Dean, "Yes, as a matter of fact, it was." Dean waxed expansive on the theological implications of bike paths, saying, "I didn't think that was very public-spirited." But recently, Dean has leapt even beyond the DLC-recommended God's green earth and begun talking about Jesus, saying, "He was a person who set an extraordinary example that has lasted 2,000 years, which is pretty inspiring when you think about it." Gosh, to hear Dean tell it, Jesus is even giving Oprah a run for her money. Also, Christ died for our sins, but let's not get into the hocus-pocus part of Christianity. The gist of the New Testament is about bike paths. Dean's relationship with Jesus is a little like David Lloyd George's relationship with the Slovaks. At the Treaty of Versailles conference, the British Prime Minister was heard to whisper, "Who are the Slovaks again? I can never place them." What happened to your queer party friends? January 21st, 2004. The endless receding nightmare of the Iowa caucuses has finally produced something interesting. The Democrats have one hellacious catfight on their hands. After all the hoopla about Howard Dean's new mass movement of Deaniacs, it appears that blanketing Iowa with self-righteous 20-year-olds in orange wool caps may not have been the ideal campaign strategy. Dean's distant third-place finish makes you want to ask him the question Jack Nicholson put to his down-and-out gay neighbor in As Good As It Gets. What happened to your queer party friends? At the behest of the Democratic Party establishment, the media dutifully destroyed Howard Dean, the legitimate leader of the opposition. Democratic voters are such lemmings. The New York Times told them to switch from Dean to John Kerry, so they all obediently switched from Dean to Kerry. But Dean still has the money and foot soldiers and endorsements to stay in the fight for the foreseeable future. And being from Vermont, Dean should do well in New Hampshire. I went to a public school, but if I remember my high school geography correctly, New Hampshire and Vermont are the same state. Until Kerry won Iowa, Wesley Clark was viewed as the preeminent electable Democrat, principally because he's a Republican. Dean said he thinks Clark is a fine fellow, but truly a Republican. In response, General Clark immediately put on a third sweater. Sadly, it may turn out that Clark's whole raison d'etre is now gone. Never was so much money, media, chicanery, Gwyneth Paltrow, Madonna, conniving, and Kabbalah deployed to promote a quote-unquote electable Democrat. Clark was supposed to be the phony American to stop Dean, but Kerry is the even better phony American, and he's already stopped Dean in Iowa. Kerry and Clark now represent the two major wings of the Democratic Party, the Kennedy wing and the Clinton wing, One drowns you after the extramarital affair, the other one calls you a stalker. Other than that, there isn't a hair's difference between any of the Democrats on any substantive issues. All the Democrats are for higher taxes. All of them favor Hillary's socialist health care plan. All of them are for higher pay for teachers and nurses and no pay at all for anyone in the pharmaceutical or oil industries, especially Halliburton executives who should be sent to Guantanamo. All the Democrats believe the way to strike fear in the hearts of the terrorists is for the federal government to invest heavily in windmills. All the Democrats oppose the war. And all the Democrats who took a position on the war before it began were for it, but now believe that everything Bush did from that moment forward has been bad, bad, bad. This is with the exception of Joe Lieberman, who, as an observant Jew, is forbidden to backpedal after sundown on Fridays. Representing a large, flabby chunk of the Kennedy wing, Ted Kennedy gave a speech last week in which he called the liberation of Iraq a political product. Then again, Ted Kennedy calls Chivas Regal that life-sustaining liquid. Finally, all the candidates are willing to sell out any of these other issues in service of the one burning desire of all Democrats, abortion on demand. If they could just figure out a way to abort babies using solar power, that's all we'd ever hear about. For all his talk, even Dick Gephardt was willing to abandon blue-collar workers in a heartbeat. The Teamsters haven't asked for much, only two big votes in the past decade. One, oppose NAFTA, and two, support drilling on a small, godforsaken patch of the Alaskan wilderness, as the people who actually live there have been begging us to do for decades. Like all the other Democrats, Gephardt voted against the Teamsters, but with Barbara Streisand, to oppose drilling in the godforsaken Alaskan wilderness. When Gephardt entered politics, he was pro-life. But then, like Al Gore, Jesse Jackson, Dennis Kucinich, and scores of other Democrats with national ambitions, he quickly figured out that position wasn't, well, viable. In short order, he had adopted the whole Narral party line. That's how you woo old-time Union Democrats. On Monday night in Iowa, Gephardt was shocked to discover that blue-collar Democrats have gone the way of all patriotic Democrats. They're all Republicans now. But thanks for that NAFTA vote a decade ago. You knew Gephardt was toast when even responsible journalists started using words like decent and solid to describe the two-faced weasel from Missouri. Though I suppose decent has a pretty broad meaning in a party that still admires Bill Clinton. The Iowa caucus was just another one of the Democrats' ongoing public debates about how to fake out the American people. 50% of Iowa Democrats participating in the caucus said they strongly disapprove of the war with Iraq, and another 25% somewhat disapprove. But more important to Democrats than their pacifism was electability. The entire Iowa electorate was committed to the proposition, "How do we fool the neighbors?" In the end, the caucus-goers chose a decorated war hero who voted in favor of the very war that 75% of them oppose. So much for the anti-war fever sweeping the country. The Democrats aren't even man enough to run a genuine coward for president. Just a Gigolo, January 28, 2004. After the New Hampshire primary, Dennis Kucinich's new slogan is, 0.001% of America can't be wrong. John Edwards's new slogan is, vote for me or we'll see you in court. Joe Lieberman's new slogan is, sixth place is not an option. Bumper sticker version, ask me about my delegate. Wesley Clark's new slogan is, leading America's war on fetuses. Howard Dean's new slogan is, I want to be your president, and so do I. Al Sharpton's new slogan is, hello? Room service? That leaves John Kerry. New slogan, nous sommes nombre un, who is winning Democratic voters in droves on the basis of his superior ability to taunt George Bush for his lack of combat experience. Like every war hero I've ever met, John Kerry seems content to spend his days bragging about his battlefield exploits. Wait, let me correct that last sentence. Like no war hero I've ever met. As everyone has heard approximately 1 billion times by now, Kerry boasts that he has real experience with aircraft carriers, and if Bush wants to run on national security, then bring it on. I note that when George Bush directed that precise phrase at Islamic terrorists who yearn to slaughter American women and children, liberals were enraged at the macho posturing of it. But they feel bring it on is a perfectly appropriate expression when directed at a dangerous warmonger like George Bush. Bring it on won out over Kerry's first impulse, let's get busy, sister. Kerry was indisputably brave in Vietnam, and it's kind of cute to see Democrats pretend to admire military service. Physical courage, like chastity, is something liberals usually deride, but are tickled about when it accidentally manifests itself in one of their own. One has to stand in awe of Kerry's military service 33 years ago. Of course, that's where it ends, including with Kerry, inasmuch as upon his return from war in 1970, he promptly began trashing his fellow Vietnam vets by calling them genocidal murderers. But if Bush can't talk to Kerry about the horrors of war, then Kerry sure as hell can't talk to anyone about the plight of the middle class. Kerry's life experience consists of living off other men's money by marrying their wives and daughters. For over 30 years, Kerry's primary occupation has been stalking lonely heiresses. Not to get back to his combat experience, but Kerry sees a room full of wealthy widows as a target-rich environment. This is a guy whose experience dealing with tax problems is based on spending his entire adult life being supported by rich women. What does a kept man know about taxes? In 1970, Kerry married into the family of Julia Thorne, a family estimated to be worth about $300 million. She got depressed, they separated, and soon he was seen catting around with Hollywood starlets, mostly while he was still married. Apparently, JFK really was his mentor. Thorne is well-bred enough to say nothing ill of her Lothario ex-husband. He is, after all, the father of her children, a fact that never seemed to constrain him. When Kerry was about to become the latest Heinz family charity, he sought to have his marriage to Thorne annulled, despite the fact that it had produced two children. It seems his second meal ticket, Teresa Heinz, wanted the first marriage annulled, and she's worth more than $700 million. Kerry claims he will stand up to powerful interests, but he can't even stand up to his wife. Heinz made Kerry sign a prenuptial agreement, presumably aware of how careless he is with other people's property, such as other people's Vietnam War medals, which Kerry threw on the ground during a 1971 anti-war demonstration. At pains to make Kerry sound like a normal American, his campaign has described how Kerry risked everything, mortgaging his home in Boston to help pay for his presidential campaign. Technically, Kerry took out a $6 million mortgage for his share of the family's home, which was bought with the Heinz family fortune. Why should he spend his own money? He didn't throw away his own medals. I'm sure the average working stiff in Massachusetts can relate to a guy who borrows $6 million against his house to pay for TV ads. Kerry's campaign has stoutly insisted that he will pay off the mortgage himself, with no help from his rich wife. Let's see. According to tax returns released by his campaign, in 2002, Kerry's income was $144,091. But as the Washington Post recently reported, even a $5 million mortgage paid back over 30 years at favorable interest rates would cost $30,389 a month or $364,668 a year. Paying it off himself, is he? The Democrats' joy at nominating Kerry is perplexing. To be sure, liberals take a peculiar, wrathful pleasure in supporting pacifist military types. And Kerry's life story is not without a certain feral aggression. But if we're going to determine fitness for office based on life experience, Kerry clearly has no experience dealing with problems of typical Americans, since he is a cad and a gigolo living in the lap of other men's money. Kerry is like some character in a Balzac novel, an adventurer twirling the end of his mustache and preying on rich women. This low-born poseur with his threadbare pseudo-Brahmin family bought a political career with one rich woman's money, dumped her, and made off with another heiress to enable him to run for president. If Democrats want to talk about middle-class tax cuts, couldn't they nominate someone who hasn't been a poodle to rich women for the past 33 years? Boobs in the News, February 4, 2004. Just to give you a snapshot of the current Democratic Party, in the North Dakota primary, Dennis Kucinich got 3 times as many votes as Joe Lieberman did. After that, Lieberman quit the race. In sympathy with Lieberman and facing similar odds, I quit the race too. To my supporters, hey, we didn't go all the way, but just look how much we accomplished. In his concession speech, Lieberman thanked each one of the Democratic presidential candidates for contributing to the race and thanked Al Sharpton in particular for inciting no additional violence against the Jews. Former front-runner Howard Dean managed to make news by ridiculing the FCC's plan to investigate MTV's halftime show at the Super Bowl. Dean pronounced the proposed investigation silly. He explained that since he's a doctor, a naked breast is not exactly an unusual phenomenon for him. That's an interesting standard. Presumably a primetime exhibition of Janet Jackson having a full pelvic exam and pap smear would not be exactly an unusual phenomenon for Dean either. Let's just be grateful Dean's not a proctologist. Meanwhile, the rest of the country was not so copacetic about being flashed with what the New York Times called Janet Jackson's middle-aged woman's breast. Janet Jackson said she decided to add the reveal following the final rehearsal, which I found pretty shocking. Not the reveal, the fact that the number in question was actually rehearsed. Even CBS executives were enraged by MTV's halftime show, saying they could have gotten the identical show from National Geographic for a fraction of the price. Speaking of boobs, after sustaining his first losses in 2 primaries Tuesday night, Senator and trophy husband John Kerry has said he's going to concentrate on solidifying the support of his base. People like David Gest, Klaus von Bulow, and Tom Arnold. Liberals laughed at George Bush for citing Jesus Christ as his favorite philosopher, but are impressed that John Kerry's favorite philosopher is Louis Prima. Just a gigolo. Kerry thinks people are dying to hear his economic plan. In fact, the only economic plan most male voters want to hear about is how Kerry snookered 2 babes worth hundreds of millions of dollars into marrying him. Kerry might as well start giving out dating tips. He's running out of other ideas. A few weeks ago, The Washington Post reported that Kerry has taken more money from paid lobbyists than any other senator over the past 15 years. In a face-saving move, Senator Botox has quietly dropped the part of his stump speech where he inveighs against Washington's special interests. We are coming, you're going, and don't let the door hit you on the way out. Interestingly, these were also Senator Kerry's words to his first wife after he hooked up with Teresa Hines. Not only that, but according to Kerry's principal cheerleaders, Teddy Kennedy and the New York Times, Kerry absolutely refuses to talk about his Vietnam service. Kennedy insists that Kerry just won't talk about Vietnam. Apparently, Vietnam was a brief, death-defying interlude that Kerry would simply prefer not to discuss. You might say it's his Chappaquiddick. In the objective part of a factual news story, the New York Times reported that Kerry has been careful to avoid being seen as exploiting his service politically. He simply will not do it. This came as a shock to most Americans, who were discovering for the very first time that Kerry had served in Vietnam. While there is indisputably nothing cooler than having fought for your country, John Kerry's status as a Vietnam veteran is unlikely to change a single vote. Military guys will support Bush, and liberals don't admire bravery. After starting the Vietnam War, the Democratic Party suddenly decided it was an illegal, immoral, undeclared war, and soldiers like John Kerry were baby killers. Today, vast majorities of Democratic primary voters tell pollsters they opposed the war in Iraq, which their boy Kerry voted for. Kerry's sole appeal is that he gives pacifist cowards cover to fume about Bush. Just a few years ago, the Democrats thought a pot-smoking draft dodger would make a splendid president. But now they act as if they are inflamed at the thought that Bush didn't fight in Vietnam. In other words, it's honorable to march in anti-American protests in Europe when America is at war, but not to be a fighter pilot in the Texas Air National Guard. Democrats know they can't beat Bush, but they intend to enjoy being hysterical about him throughout the campaign. Calling Bush a draft dodger, which he is not, will join the Democrats' list of other cogent, reasoned arguments, such as, "You're stupid," and "Halliburton." Democrats think they invented war heroes, but being a war hero didn't help Bob Dole. It didn't help George Herbert Walker Bush. It didn't help John McCain. The Democrats didn't invent war heroes. What they invented is the scam of deploying war heroes to argue for surrender. In desperate move, Kerry adopts puppy. July 7, 2004. I guess with John Kerry's choice of John Edwards as his running mate, he really does want to stand up for all Americans, from those worth only $60 million to those worth in excess of $800 million. In one of the many stratagems Democrats have developed to avoid telling people what they believe, all Edwards wants to talk about is his Cracker Barrel humble origin story. We're supposed to swoon over his life story, as the flacks say, which apparently consists of the amazing fact that his father was a mill worker. That's right up there with Clinton's stepdad was a drunk and Ted Kennedy's dad was a womanizing bootlegger on my inspirational life stories meter. In fact, I'm immediately renouncing my university degrees and going to work for the post office just to give my future children a shot at having a life story should they decide to run for president someday. What is so amazing about Edwards' father being a mill worker? That's at least an honorable occupation, as opposed to being a trial lawyer. True, Edwards made more money than his father did. I assume strippers make more money than their alcoholic fathers who abandoned them did, too. This isn't a story of progress. It's a story of devolution. Despite the overwrought claims of Edwards' dazzling legal skills, winning jury verdicts in personal injury cases has nothing to do with legal talent and everything to do with getting the right cases, unless talent is taken to mean having absolutely no shame. Edwards specialized in babies with cerebral palsy, who he claimed would have been spared the affliction if only the doctors had immediately performed cesarean sections. As a result of such lawsuits, there are now more than four times as many cesarean sections as there were in 1970. But curiously, there has been no change in the rate of babies born with cerebral palsy. As the New York Times reported, studies indicate that in most cases, the disorder is caused by fetal brain injury long before labor begins. All those cesareans have, however, increased the mother's risk of death, hemorrhage, infection, pulmonary embolism, and Mendelssohn's syndrome. In addition, the little guys Edwards claims to represent are having a lot more trouble finding doctors to deliver their babies these days as obstetricians leave the practice rather than pay malpractice insurance in excess of $100,000 a year. In one of Edwards' silver-tongued arguments to the jury on behalf of a girl born with cerebral palsy, he claimed he was channeling the unborn baby girl, Jennifer Campbell, who was speaking to the jurors through him. She said at 3, "I'm fine." She said at 4, "I'm having a little trouble, but I'm doing okay." 5, she said, "I'm having problems." At 5:30, she said, "I need out." She's saying, "My lawyer needs a new Jaguar." She speaks to you through me, and I have to tell you right now, I didn't plan to talk about this. Right now, I feel her. I feel her presence. She's inside me, and she's talking to you. Well, tell her to pipe down, would you? I'm trying to hear the evidence in a malpractice lawsuit. To paraphrase Oscar Wilde on the death of Little Nell, one must have a heart of stone to read this without laughing. What is this guy, a tent show preacher? An off-the-strip Las Vegas lounge psychic couldn't get away with this routine. Is Edwards able to channel any children right before an abortionist's fork is plunged into their tiny skulls? Why can't he hear those babies saying, "Let me live! Stop spraying this saline solution all over me!" Edwards must experience interference in channeling the voices of babies about to be aborted. Their liberal mother's hands seem to muffle those voices. And may we ask what the pre-born Jennifer Campbell thinks about war with Iraq, North Korea, marginal tax rates? If Miss Cleo here is going to be a heartbeat away from the presidency, I think the voters are entitled to know that. While making himself fabulously rich by taking a one-third cut of his multi-million-dollar verdicts, coaxed out of juries with junk science and maudlin performances, Edwards has the audacity to claim, "I was more than just their lawyer. I cared about them. Their cause was my cause." If he cared so deeply, how about keeping just 10% of the multi-million-dollar jury awards rather than a third? In fact, as long as these Democrats are so eager to raise the taxes of the rich, how about a 90% tax on contingency fees? For someone who didn't care about the money, it's interesting that Edwards avoided cases in which the baby died during delivery. Evidently, jury awards average only about $500,000 when the babies die, and there is no disabled child to parade before the jury. Edwards was one of the leading opponents of a bill in the North Carolina legislature that would have established a fund for all babies born with cerebral palsy. So, instead of all disabled babies in North Carolina being compensated equitably, only a few will win the jury lottery, one-third of which will go to trial lawyers like Edwards, who insists he doesn't care about the money. Despite the now-disproved junk science theory about C-sections preventing cerebral palsy that Edwards peddled in the channeling case, the jury awarded Edwards' client a record-breaking $6.5 million. This is the essence of the modern Democratic Party, polished to perfection by Bill Clinton. They are willing to insult the intelligence of 49% of the people if they think they can fool 51% of the people. So, while Michael Moore, Al Franken, George Soros, crazy Al Gore, and the rest of the characters from the climactic devil-worshipping scene in Rosemary's Baby provide the muscle for the Kerry campaign, Kerry picks a pretty boy milquetoast as his running mate, narrowly edging out a puppy for the spot. Just don't ask the Democrats what they believe. Edwards' father was a mill worker, and that's all you need to know. Chapter 5. Barbara Streisand feels your pain, according to her publicist. I like black people too, Julia. March 28, 2002. I tuned in late and consequently can speak only to the last 3 hours of Halle Berry's acceptance speech at the Academy Awards last Sunday. But inasmuch as she engaged in wild race-baiting to get her Oscar, Berry's expressions of shock were not very believable. She had spent weeks complaining about one time she did not get a role because of her color. It was the part of a forest ranger. Arnold Schwarzenegger probably has trouble getting roles as a ballet dancer, too. And yet still, somehow, white guilt worked on Hollywood liberals. Berry had successfully mau-mau'd her way to a Best Actress award and then acted surprised. It's interesting that Berry makes such a big deal about being black. She was raised by her white mother, who was beaten and abandoned by her black father. But clearly, Berry has calculated that it is more advantageous for her acting career to identify with the man who abandoned her rather than the woman who raised her. Demanding that everyone marvel at her accomplishment, Berry gushed, "This moment is so much bigger than me." Whenever people say something is not about them, it's always just about them. This is a turn of phrase meant to remind the audience of the importance and beauty of them. Barry said her triumph was a victory for every nameless, faceless woman of color who now has a chance because this door tonight has been opened. Yes, at long last, the glass ceiling had been broken. Large-breasted, slightly cocoa women with idealized Caucasian features will finally have a chance in Hollywood. They will, however, still be required to display their large breasts for the camera and to discuss their large breasts at some length with reporters. Thus, Barry has explained her philosophy on nude scenes, saying, "If it's what the character would do, then I'd use my body in any way that would best serve that character." This, she said, is her strong belief. But what does it mean exactly? Don't all people undress sometimes? All people pick their noses, but vapid Hollywood actresses don't insist on showing us that in every movie, on the grounds that it is what the character would do. In fact, Barry's unseemly enthusiasm for displaying these babies, as she genteelly refers to her breasts, reduces the number of roles for any women who lack Barry's beauty queen features. If movies must include soft porn scenes, the audience is entitled to demand performers with sexual characteristics they would like to see in a soft porn movie. Somehow, characters played by Whoopi Goldberg are never the sort of characters who would do things in real life like undress or have sex. And, by the way, Billy Bob Thornton isn't cutting it for the female audience. When they are young, nubile Hollywood actresses all utter the same idiotic clichés about the artistic value of nudity in movies. Then they expect us to feel sorry for them when parts dry up after they become old and start to sag. Live by the breast, die by the breast. But Barry's self-aggrandizing pap was merely a footnote to the main event of the awards ceremony, which was Julia Roberts loves all the black brothers. It was a point Roberts felt could not be made too often or with too much condescension. Her presentation of the Best Actor Award began with the exciting revelation that she had just kissed Sidney Poitier. Having once dramatically proclaimed she did not want to live in a world in which Denzel Washington had not won an Oscar for Best Actor, Roberts preceded her announcement of Washington's award saying, "I love my life." This was about her, not him. It was Julia Roberts's personal triumph over racism. The only patronizing remark Roberts skipped was to note that Washington and Poitier were articulate. After Washington accepted his award, Roberts leapt on him and would not let go. It was as if he had grown some sort of exotic Julia Roberts wart. Washington, and more urgently his wife, deserve great credit for their forbearance. Whatever indignities Hollywood has visited on blacks in the past, it would be hard to top Roberts's performance. Apparently, Oscar night was Hollywood's shot at patronizing blacks to generate goodwill, perhaps as wartime penance for its long-standing hatred of America. Like clockwork, whenever white liberals are in trouble, they run to the blacks. After his abomination of a presidency, Jimmy Carter built housing in Harlem. Immediately after the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke, Monica went to a Washington Wizards game, where she hoisted some poor, unsuspecting black girl onto her lap in full view of the TV cameras. Bill Clinton dropped the subtlety and dashed off to Africa. It's too bad Denzel Washington's Oscar was tainted by Hollywood's self-serving night of condescension. He deserved that award. And he deserves a special award for not punching Julia Roberts in the mouth. Dumb Hires Dumber, November 9, 1999. Just when you thought Al Gore could get no more comical, it turns out he's been taking masculinity lessons from a feminist. Since January, the Gore campaign had been covertly funneling $15,000 a month to controversial feminist author Naomi Wolf, as she is invariably described. The payments were funneled through other consulting firms, thus eliminating the embarrassing prospect of having to mention her name in the campaign's reports to the FEC. As has been widely reported, Wolf advised the vice president to shed his beta male characteristics and become an alpha male like Bill Clinton, who is virile in the sense that a filthy, rabid stray dog humping your ankle is virile. The insight that first caught Al's attention was Wolf's article in the June 1998 George magazine titled Al's Inner Alien. Gore should let his defenses down and allow his inner oddness out. While it's true the citizens of this nation don't want a pervert and crook in the Oval Office, I don't know that we're clamoring for an idiot either. There would have been enough guffaws to go around if Bill Bradley had been caught paying exorbitant fees to some bimbo babbling about alpha males and earth tones. But it was nearly perfect that it was Gore. This was dumb hiring dumber. Gore already gives off a strong impression of being mentally deficient. It has something to do with his habit of enunciating basic points as if he's talking to extremely slow 4-year-olds, to say nothing of his lunatic claims to having invented the internet and been the inspiration for Love Story. But then he was caught paying a ludicrous salary to a mind-bogglingly stupid girl. To be sure, stupid isn't the worst thing in the world. The worst thing in the world is stupid trying to pass itself off as smart. Like Gore, Wolf insists on posing as a great intellect instead of just working at Hooters. One wonders if, like Gore, Naomi's friends also claim she's much smarter and uproariously funny in person. In her latest book, Promiscuities, Wolf argued, if that is the appropriate verb, that schools should teach teenagers masturbation and oral sex. If we don't act now, onanism could become a lost art. Teaching sexual gradualism is as sensible as teaching kids to drive, Wolf says. Adding sexual gradualism to the high school curriculum, now that's what I call a workable stay-in-school program. I'm all for the government teaching our kids how to have sex, provided they also have to be licensed by the DMV before they go at each other. In fact, I don't know why we couldn't combine sex ed with driver's ed just for the sake of efficiency. Why not require an operator's license issued by the DMV for any kid who wants to have sex? I'm picturing millions of kids who think they're finally going to have sex, only to be told, "You don't have the right form. Go to the back of the line." It is that kind of out-of-the-box thinking, as Gore Press Secretary Chris Lehane described Wolf's talent, that gets you paid $180,000 per year by the Gore campaign. Except teaching kids to masturbate really isn't that new an idea. Indeed, for quite some time, liberals have been not only discussing, but sometimes actually teaching small children things I can't discuss in a family newspaper. That's what got New York City Schools Chancellor Joseph Fernandez removed from office as long ago as February 1993, and Clinton's Surgeon General Jocelyn Elders fired in 1995, to mention a few times this out-of-the-box thinking has been thought of before. Shh. No one tell the Gore campaign. Now, I don't know much about that fancy out-of-the-box thinking, but it seems to me such thinking must, at a minimum, consist of ideas that 47 people haven't thought of before. Wolf's only serious advice to Gore was, distance yourself from Clinton. Not to brag, but I've been giving the whole country that advice totally free for quite some time now. $15,000 a month. The money was good, especially for the breadwinner for a growing family, as Wolf claimed to be. Her husband must have enjoyed hearing that. Still, Wolf resented her anonymity in the Gore campaign. Indeed, Time magazine says Wolf's claims that she had been trying to disguise her role in the campaign came as news to some Gore campaign officials. To the contrary, campaign officials said Wolf had been agitating for a more public profile. She made an ostentatious appearance at Gore's New Hampshire debate and ignored suggestions to stay away from reporters. After her cunning plan of talking to reporters somehow failed to keep her role a secret, Wolf ignored the Gore campaign's request that she not go on TV and discuss her role any further. This was her out-of-the-box thinking, for which I am most grateful. On ABC's This Week, George Will asked Wolfe what she meant about Gore being a Blakeian deep inside, as she had said in her article, Al's Inner Alien. She may as well have been asked to do long division. While clearly having no idea, Wolfe proclaimed delight that they were talking about 19th-century romantic and mystical poets. No, they weren't, actually, and not only because Blake was mostly an 18th-century poet. They were talking about a 19th-century poet who was actually an 18th-century poet. Whenever really stupid people try to sound intellectual, this is as far as they get. Non-substantive recitations of important-sounding names. They love to exclaim that they are talking about poets, world leaders, or God when all they're doing is saying the names. I'm pleased, but I can't believe at this early in the morning, she said, we are talking about poets. When the seemingly interminable subject of the subject had at last been exhausted, Wolfe explained how Gore was a Blakeian by unleashing a series of meaningless clichés. What I'm talking about is a vision that incorporates many disparate parts for a whole that's more than the sum of its parts. The clichés ultimately led, somehow, to the stirring conclusion that Gore was a Blakeian because of his yearning to resolve this critical federal crisis. How do you get working parents home in time so that they have a chance to read a bedtime story to their kids? Another of Wolfe's other self-described wacky and larger picture ideas were things like school uniforms. George Will dryly asked the larger picture gal, "Whoever said school uniforms are wacky, by the way?" In her tawdry book, Promiscuities, Wolfe unloads a tanker of out-of-the-box thoughts. She writes, for example, if 13-year-old Juliet were to fall in love with Romeo today, she could get a condom in the ladies' room of the train station and instructions from Cosmo, your sexual style, and Shakespeare would have to look elsewhere for his plot. No. The problem fair Juliet had with Romeo was not that she could not find suitable birth control. But then Naomi and I went to different schools. Different planets, if you credit her account. It may explain a lot that she's the one teaching Al Gore to be a man. Checks and balances, but mostly checks. July 31st, 2002. Having dragged a group of Manhattan elites back from the Hamptons in the summer of 2002 to attend a fundraiser at a Tony Chelsea nightclub, Al Gore criticized the Bush administration for working on behalf of the powerful and letting the people of this country get the short end of the stick. Back when he was exhibiting the Democrats' renowned good sportsmanship after he lost the presidential election, Gore managed to fund his tantrum with donations sent in from such ordinary Americans such as dot-com multimillionaire Stephen Kirsch, $500,000, former Slim Fast Foods chief S. Daniel Abraham, $100,000, and Minneapolis multimillionaire Vance Opperman, $100,000. He got help from the Manhattan working poor, such as Lowe's Hotel Scion and Tobacco Company beneficiary John Tisch, $50,000, ex-wife of pardoned financier Mark Rich, Denise Rich, $25,000, and investment banker John Corzine, $25,000, who is now representing working families against the powerful in the U.S. Senate. Also moved by Gore's pledge to fight for working families were some of Hollywood's typical working families. Notorious inseminator and Hollywood producer Stephen Bing ponied up $200,000. In Democratic Party parlance, producer evidently means a do-nothing who inherited a lot of money. Actress and traitor Jane Fonda gave the Gore-Lieberman Fund $100,000. By contrast, George W. Bush limited donations to his election recount fund to $5,000 or less. But normal Americans saw what the Democrats were up to, and thousands upon thousands of small contributions poured into Bush from across the country. Bush raised 4 times as much money as Gore did. Even with individual donations of $500,000, Gore raised only $3.2 million. Small individual donors, none contributing more than $5,000, gave $13.8 million to Bush. 2/3 of Gore's tantrum fund came from just 38 rich liberals who contributed $2.1 million. 84 individuals donated $2.8 million of Gore's $3.2 million recount fund. This in a country of 280 million people. Without Malibu, there would be no Democratic Party. Of the 84 rich liberals who nearly single-handedly bankrolled Gore's tantrum fund, 30 were from California and 23 from New York. And that doesn't include rich liberals who ought to be in Malibu, but whose legal residence is Georgia, like Jane Fonda. Only $56,216 of the entire Gore-Lieberman fund came from donations of $200 or less. That is about half the size of the check cut by Jane Fonda to Gore's fund. Bush raised more than the entire amount of Gore's fund in individual donations of $200 or less. The tale of the two recount funds once again proved the division between the two parties as those who make their own beds and those who do not. But that's not the story the media told. Amazingly, the media turned the facts upside down, absurdly implying that Bush had been bankrolled by billionaires while Gore made do with small donations from the working poor. The genuine and spontaneous outrage of ordinary Americans against a small band of Democratic royalists became another story about mythical rich Republicans beating down the working class with their polo mallets. Newspaper headlines simply ignored the size of the individual donations and instead broadcast only the raw totals of the two funds, amid copious reminders that Republicans are the party of the rich. In an article titled "Bush Far Outspent Gore on Recount," the Washington Post referred to the powerful fundraising abilities of the Republican Party. The Chicago Tribune's headline was "Bush spent 4 times as much as Gore in Florida recount," and the AP headline was "IRS, Bush spent 4 times as much as Gore on Florida recount." How about Gore bankrolled by 84, small donors flock to Bush, billionaires to Gore, or Malibu pool party finances 7/8 of Gore recount fund? A year later, the Democratic National Committee took in its largest single donation ever, $5 million from producer Stephen Bing, our featured Democrat this week. In the current Vanity Fair, Bing is described by other Hollywood billionaires as a self-effacing, modest man. As evidence, they note that he has only one maid. Name anyone else with his wealth who has only one maid, Man of the People Rob Reiner says. You'd be hard-pressed. I'd be hard-pressed to think of one of my friends who has a maid. Marie Antoinette did not flaunt her wealth the way progressive liberals in America do. Other Hollywood progressives commented on how Bing helps strippers when they're down on their luck, and, one may surmise, also down on their knees. I've helped so many, Bing says, you'd have to get me the names. That's self-effacing for a liberal. Bing's admiration for the underclass is mainly shown by his predilection for siring children out of wedlock. This seems to be the new status symbol among liberals, with Bing currently leading Jesse Jackson 2-1 in disclosed illegitimate children. Question: how do you empty a room full of rich liberals? Answer: ask for a paternity test. In a romance born of progressivism, the mother of one of Bing's illegitimate children, Elizabeth Hurley, crossed a Screen Actors Guild picket line, and Bing gallantly paid her fine to the union. So much for the little people. Also, he plays blues on the piano. I take it back. He is a man of the people. Interestingly, Bing doesn't make a fuss about the estate tax. His professional accomplishments amount to having dropped out of Stanford, which we can assume he did not enter on the basis of his SAT scores, and then spending a decade writing a single episode of Married with Children. Bing's credentials as a producer are as credible as his belief that women are not attracted to him for his money. The current Democratic Party is a crowd of idle, rich degenerates, the likes of which hasn't existed since the Tsar's court. When not occupied with abortions or strippers, they busy themselves denouncing the Cossacks as the powerful. The Robert C. Byrd Bridge to Poverty, February 14, 2002. The poor's sense of class superiority over the rich is getting out of hand. At a Senate Budget Committee hearing last week, Senator Robert Byrd, who was named after a bridge in West Virginia, viciously attacked Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill for having made a success of himself. Claiming to speak for worthless layabouts, Byrd snippily informed O'Neill, "They're not CEOs of multi-billion-dollar corporations. In time of need, they come to us. The people come to us." And evidently, what the people in need are crying out for are a lot of federal projects named after Senator Byrd. Some items paid for by taxpayers, but inexplicably named after Robert C. Byrd, are the Robert C. Byrd Highway, the Robert C. Byrd Locks and Dam, the Robert C. Byrd Institute, the Robert C. Byrd Lifelong Learning Center, the Robert C. Byrd Honors Scholarship Program, the Robert C. Byrd Green Bank Telescope, the Robert C. Byrd Institute for Advanced Flexible Manufacturing, the Robert C. Byrd Federal Courthouse, the Robert C. Byrd Health Sciences Center, the Robert C. Byrd Academic and Technology Center, the Robert C. Byrd United Technical Center, the Robert C. Byrd Federal Building, the Robert C. Byrd Drive, the Robert C. Byrd Hilltop Office Complex, the Robert C. Byrd Library, the Robert C. Byrd Learning Resource Center, the Robert C. Byrd Rural Health Center. And then it got late and I had to stop searching Google. But it appears that every slab of concrete in West Virginia is named after Bob Byrd. Really warming to his class envy tirade, the King Tut of the Senate further informed O'Neill, "I haven't walked in any corporate boardrooms. I haven't had to turn any millions of dollars into trust accounts. I wish I had those millions of dollars." Instead, Byrd had to scrape by with billions of dollars, forcibly extracted from the taxpayers to build grotesque Banana Republic tributes to himself. At least the money O'Neill turned into trust accounts came from his own pocket. Coincidentally, the money Byrd turned into eponymous monuments also came from O'Neill's pocket. A humble display of gratitude to O'Neill might have been more appropriate. An astonished O'Neill responded to the harangue, "I started my life in a house without water or electricity, so I don't cede to you the high moral ground of not knowing what life is like in a ditch." And then the hearing spun totally out of control as Senator Tut redoubled his own sob story. "Well, Mr. Secretary, I lived in a house without electricity, too. No running water, no telephone, a little wooden outhouse." Though Byrd was manifestly enamored of all the tiny particulars of his life story, he unaccountably skipped the part about his youthful membership in the Ku Klux Klan. When did a lack of money and accomplishment become a mark of virtue? Some rich people may be swine, but so are some poor people. A lot of rich people work harder, are more creative, and are a lot nicer than the poor, especially rich people who earned it themselves, unlike Democratic senators. Paul O'Neill was never in the Klan, and Paul O'Neill never filched taxpayers' hard-earned money to build a vast complex of shrines to himself. More perplexingly, when did a scoundrel whose only source of capital comes from other people's paychecks assume the high ground over a rich man who gave people paychecks? Paul O'Neill is rich. I'm not. Oh, well. At least he didn't steal half my paycheck. Every society must have concentrations of wealth in order to build and create. Even the Soviet Union of beloved memory had concentrations of wealth, but it was in the government rather than in corporations. It's called capital. Capital is needed to launch society's most important projects, factories, bridges, skyscrapers, inventions, and telescopes named after Bob Byrd. O'Neill's concentration of money came to him through the voluntary decisions of investors and consumers. Byrd's far larger concentration of money came to him by force. Send half your paycheck to the government or go to jail. The lie at the heart of liberals' mantra on tax cuts for the rich, is the ineluctable fact that unless taxes are cut across the board, nobody's taxes ever get cut. As loaded Hollywood liberals are always reminding us, they don't need a tax cut. Alas, the rich we shall always have with us, kind of like the poor. At least conservatives defend the right of middle-class people to keep their money, too. The only rich people deserving of malice are rich liberals who express bemusement at the non-rich's desire for a tax cut. In their campaign to make the middle class pay more in taxes, liberals use the lumpen poor as a battering ram against these hated, acquisitive coupon clippers. Despite his maudlin self-flattery, Robert Byrd and the rest of his party don't resent the rich on behalf of the poor. They resent the rich on behalf of the government. Poor Senator Byrd can't rest, knowing there may still be a toilet in West Virginia that is not named for Bob Byrd. Chair Warmer on the Hot Seat, March 24, 2004. Are you sitting down? Another ex-government official who was fired or demoted by Bush has written a book that is critical of Bush. Eureka. The latest offering is Richard Clark's new CBS Viacom book, Against All Enemies, which gets only a 35 on Rate a Record because the words don't make sense and you can't dance to it. For those of you who haven't heard of Dick Clark, that is to say, all of you, he's a career backbencher who was passed over as National Security Advisor in favor of Condoleezza Rice, who later demoted him. Speaking of hidden agendas. As long as we're investigating everything, how about investigating why some loser no one has ever heard of is getting so much press coverage for yet another tell-all book attacking the Bush administration? Kiss and tell books about the Bush administration by disgruntled ex-employees looking to make a quick buck are coming out as fast as Elvis and Me books by distant relatives of the king after his death. This is not to compare the two. At least the authors of the Elvis books had more than facial expressions to report. When an FBI agent with close, regular contact with President Clinton wrote his book, he was virtually blacklisted from the mainstream media. Upon the release of Gary Aldrich's book Unlimited Access in 1996, White House advisor George Stephanopoulos immediately called TV producers demanding that they give Aldrich no airtime. Larry King Live and NBC's Dateline abruptly canceled their scheduled interviews with Aldrich. Aldrich was mentioned on fewer than a dozen TV shows during the entire year of his book's release, many with headlines like this one on CNN. Even conservatives back away from Aldrich's book. That's almost as much TV as Lewinsky mouthpiece William Ginsburg did before breakfast on an average day. Let's take a moment here to imagine the indignity of being known as Monica Lewinsky's mouthpiece. In terms of TV exposure, Aldrich's book might as well have been titled No Access Whatsoever. But a tell-all book that attacks the Bush administration gets the author interviewed on CBS's 60 Minutes, two segments, CNN's American Morning, and ABC's Good Morning America, with an analysis by George Stephanopoulos, no less. In the first few days of its release, Clark's book was hyped on more than 200 TV shows. In contrast to Aldrich's book, which was vindicated with a whoop just a few years later when the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke, many of Clark's allegations were disproven within days of the book's release. Clark claims, for example, that in early 2001, when he told Condoleezza Rice about Al-Qaeda, her facial expression gave me the impression that she had never heard the term before. If only she used Botox like Senator Kerry. Sean Hannity has been playing a radio interview that Dr. Rice gave to David Newman on WJR in Detroit back in October 2000, in which she discusses al-Qaeda in some detail. This was months before Chair Warmer Clark claims her facial expression indicated she had never heard of the terrorist organization. But in deference to our liberal friends, let's leave aside the facts for now. A few months before Clark was interpreting Dr. Rice's facial expression, al-Qaeda had bombed the USS Cole. 2 years before that, al-Qaeda bombed U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. In fact, al-Qaeda or their allies had been responsible for a half-dozen attacks on U.S. interests since Clinton had become president. Paper pusher Clark was doing one heck of a job, wasn't he? In the year 2000 alone, LexisNexis lists 280 items mentioning al-Qaeda. By the end of 2000, anyone who read the paper had heard of al-Qaeda. It is literally insane to imagine that Condoleezza Rice had not. For Pete's sake, even the New York Times knew about al-Qaeda. Rice had been a political science professor at Stanford University, a member of the Center for International Security and Arms Control, and a senior fellow of the Stanford Institute for International Studies. She had written 3 books and numerous articles on foreign policy. She worked for the first Bush administration in a variety of national security positions. All this was while Clark was presiding over 6 unanswered al-Qaeda attacks on American interests and fretting about the looming Y2K emergency. Of course, Madeleine Albright also had some fancy degrees and important positions, so let me add, anyone who has listened to Rice for 60 seconds knows that she is very smart. But Chair Warmer Clark claims that on the basis of Rice's facial expression, he could tell she was not familiar with the term al-Qaeda. Isn't that just like a liberal? The Chair Warmer describes Bush as a cowboy and Rumsfeld as his gunslinger, but the black chick is a dummy. Maybe even as dumb as Clarence Thomas. Perhaps someday, liberals could map out the relative intelligence of various black government officials for us. Did Clark have the vaguest notion of Rice's background and education? Or did he think Dr. Rice was cleaning the old executive office building at night before the president chose her, not him, to be national security advisor? If a Republican ever claimed the facial expression on Maxine Waters, a woman whose face is no stranger to confusion or befuddlement, left the impression that she didn't understand quantum physics, he'd be in prison for committing a hate crime. As we know from Dr. Rice's radio interview describing the threat of al-Qaeda back in October 2000, she certainly didn't need to be told about al-Qaeda by a government time server. No doubt, Dr. Rice was staring at Clark in astonishment as he imparted this great insight. Keep an eye on al-Qaeda. We've done nothing, but you should do something about it. Tag, you're it. The look of perplexity Clark saw was Condi thinking to herself, did I demote this guy far enough? Chapter 6. When bad ideas, liberalism, happen to good people, you. The New York Times' Crusade Against Capitalism, January 24, 2002. Before the New York Times starts running Portraits in Grief of former Enron employees, it's worth remembering that even after the collapse, Enron stock is still worth more than the entire Social Security Trust Fund. Liberals have suspended their typical class envy paradigm long enough to weep huge crocodile tears for the almost rich. Weren't these the precise people we were trained to hate in the 90s, as they high-fived one another amid extravagant claims of retirement by age 40? In record time, we've gone from schadenfreude to lachrymose liberal pity. Poor ghetto blacks must be transfixed by the turn of events that supplanted them with erstwhile yuppie scum as the new class war victims. When this much bathos is expended on middle-class white people with stock portfolios, liberals are up to no good. The only coherence to the Times' wildly contradictory feelings toward rich yuppies is that they want to scare people away from the stock market. The Times is openly rooting for a prolonged recession, if not a depression. They are desperately trying to destroy people's faith in the market, in 401ks, in capitalism. When President Bush merely acknowledged that the economy was in a recession soon after he took office, liberals screamed that he was talking down the economy. But now liberals are willing to wreck the whole country to help the Democratic Party. A continuing weak stock market would serve the Democrats' short-term interest of bashing Bush, as well as their long-term interest of keeping Americans dependent on the government. Thus, the Times cites Enron in order to sneer about the view that investing in the market would provide Americans with robust retirement funds amid snippy references to the now dormant idea of privatizing Social Security. Even the Times' pet cause of campaign finance reform is somehow more urgently needed in the wake of Enron's collapse. The morality play being showcased in the Times concerns the plight of loyal workers who lost retirement savings while company officials cashed in $1.1 billion in stock. This puts a human face on the Times' vicious attacks on the integrity of markets. Not so fast. Even if Enron executives had sold no stock whatsoever in 2001, Enron shares would still be worthless. Enron executives may well be guilty of criminal misconduct. That